order to be able to see connections and analogies when he saw something like them somewhere else. He stocked up on mental patterns in one place so he could apply them somewhere else. Now, I'm not arguing that we should all be von Neumanns, nor am I urging you to memorize the backs of technical textbooks. The lesson's much more general and applies to a well-rounded education in literature and the humanities as well. Pay attention to patterns and templates, patterns of reasoning, templates for decision-making, ways of life. Tuck them away for future reference. Those may come in handy in some other context. What I want you to take home from this lecture are two fast and frugal heuristics that allow you to squeeze knowledge from ignorance. One's the recognition heuristic. Remember San Diego and San Antonio. The other is the wisdom of crowds. Remember Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Now, remember satisficing, a decision heuristic where you need to move fast, set reasonable criteria, and take the first option that's good enough. Trust emotions for the short-term contexts that they're made for. For long-range decisions, you'd better use your head as well as your gut. In this lecture, I've emphasized the sunny side of conceptual patterns, but there's a dark side too, a dark side you can see in some of the mistakes we make. We'll talk about those in the next lecture. Oh yes, at the beginning I mentioned one of Einstein's early papers on a heuristic point of view concerning the generation and transformation of light. I noted that he used the term heuristic to indicate how sketchy and incomplete the work was. That was the paper for which he received the Nobel Prize. Why do we make mistakes? How many times have you berated yourself for what, looking back on it, was a really stupid mistake? What was I thinking? How could I do that? That was a really stupid mistake. A friend or a spouse or a passerby may try to make you feel better. You're only human. Everybody makes mistakes. Turns out there's a lot of truth in that. To err is human. Systematic error, not random, but systematic and predictable, is built into some of the ways we think. Systematic error is even built into how we see things. That's what this lecture is about, the ways that we as humans systematically go wrong and how we can correct for them. We don't have to be victims of our own systematic mistakes. If we are aware of cognitive biases, we can compensate for them. Let's start with some built-in biases. I have emphasized the power of visualization in a number of lectures. Because of our evolutionary heritage, people are particularly good at fast information processing in visual contexts. We've been exploiting that ability at every opportunity. We used it, for example, in using Venn diagrams and flow diagrams to convert abstract relations into something we can see. But our evolutionary heritage comes with certain built-in biases as well. There are perceptual heuristics built into the system that systematically mislead us. And that's what optical illusions are all about. A prime example is color vision. Look at squares A and B in this first image. Which is darker, patch A or patch B? Clearly A is. That's obvious. You can see that A is darker. But if we clip out those bits from the picture, move them over and put them side by side, things look entirely different. Patches A and B are, in fact, exactly the same shade of gray. Why is it that they look so different in the original picture? Here's the theory. In the context of that picture, square B is shown in shadow. Our perceptual system seems to compensate for that fact by making it appear lighter, as it takes its color to really be. It sees the shadow and compensates for the shadow by telling us that square B must really be lighter in color, and it tells us that by making B look lighter. We may think we see shades of color the way they are, but our perceptual system isn't built to see pure colors. It isn't built to detect the same wavelengths at different spots on a two-dimensional image. It's built to detect differences in a three-dimensional world, a world with real shadows. How long in our evolutionary history have we been dealing with three-dimensional contexts and real shadows? Millions of years. That's what the system was built for. How long have we been dealing with two-dimensional representations like the one you just saw? Not very long at all. It's only when we take bits of this two-dimensional picture out of that three-dimensional context and put them side by side that we see that our system has misled us as to the true wavelength of the patches in the picture. The same thing happens with color. We can put dots of orange in squares A and B, dots of precisely the same wavelength. If we do, the one in the shadow will shine bright orange, the one out of shadow will look dull and darker. The heuristics built into our perceptual system were built for one kind of context, a three-dimensional world with real shadows. If you have to judge things in a different context, for example, if you're an artist judging color in a two-dimensional representation, you'll have to adjust for that built-in bias. We have similar built-in biases regarding judgments of length. Take a look at the tops of these two tables. Which one's narrower? Which one's closer to a square? Amazingly, the two shapes you see are precisely the same. Why don't they look the same? We're judging them as if we're viewing a three-dimensional scene. And in order for a three-dimensional scene to project those shapes onto your retina, you'd need a narrow table on the left and a fat square table on the right. Our perceptual system is made to detect the way things really are in the world, so it sees them that way. In a two-dimensional context, on the other hand, those shapes are exactly the same. The lesson? In a two-dimensional context, our perceptual system continues to carry a three-dimensional bias. If we're dealing with two-dimensional representations, we'll have to compensate for that. The table illusion persists even if we remove the clues of the legs. There's another surprising thing about these optical illusions. Even after we know the colors are the same, they still look different. Even after we know the two shapes are the same, they still look different. People often talk about how belief influences perception. They say that you see what you want to see, or that you see what you expect to see. And these optical illusions offer a counterexample. In cases like this, mere belief seems powerless in the face of our built-in perceptual biases. We know perfectly well that those two shapes are the same. We know perfectly well that those two shades are identical. But our built-in perceptual biases seem to ignore what we know. They still look different. Some of our mistakes are built into our information processing higher up. One source of error is attention bias. It's not true that we always see what we want to see or what we expect to see, and it's a good thing that we don't. But it's sometimes true that we don't see what we don't expect to see, particularly if we're concentrating on something else. There's a 1-minute video from a famous experiment on attention bias that shows two groups of people, some in black shirts, some in white shirts, interweaving in a small room as they pass basketballs to one another. If you were a subject participating in the experiment, you'd have been told to count the number of times the basketball is passed from one white team member to another. At about the 30-second mark in the video, a person in a gorilla costume enters the room. The gorilla pauses, thumps his chest, and leaves after about 5 seconds. All this time, the subjects have been trying to count the number of basketball passes. A few minutes later, they're asked, "Did you see anything unusual?" Amazingly, about half the experimental subjects failed to see the gorilla. They were concentrating on counting ball passes. They weren't expecting a gorilla, and so they didn't see it. Even when specifically asked, "Did you see anything unusual?" the answer was no. If you go online to watch the video, of course, you will see the gorilla. You'll be looking for it. You may find it hard to believe that anyone would miss the gorilla. But then again, you may have been one of the people who failed to notice that the color of my shirt and tie changed after you saw the gorilla. If so, you are a victim of what's called change blindness. There are people in the movie industry whose job it is to assure continuity between scenes, to make sure that Indiana Jones's hat doesn't change color between shots, for example. How many people will notice that kind of change? The answer is surprisingly few. The 1959 Hollywood classic Ben-Hur won 11 Academy Awards. The most famous scene is the chariot race with Charlton Heston. It lasts 11 minutes on screen, though I'm told it took months to film. But even that famous scene has continuity problems. The race starts with 9 chariots. 6 crash in the scene. That should leave 3. But if you watch it, you'll see that the race actually ends with 4. In videos constructed for psychological experiments, people often don't even notice that an actor has changed, that it's a completely different person carrying the action from one scene to the next. And it's not just changes on screen that we tend to notice. Daniel Simons and Daniel Levin, then at Cornell, performed an experiment in which a stranger asks a person for directions. During their conversation, 2 people carrying a door walk between them. But there's a twist. The experimenters had one of the door carriers change places with the stranger as the door went by. So the conversation begins with one person, a door goes by, the conversation ends with someone else. In that experiment, only 7 out of 15 people noticed the switch. Attention, then, comes with its own biases. We tend not to notice things that aren't at the focus of our attention, even when that thing is a gorilla. We're change blind. We often don't notice when things change. There are other gaps in our information processing. As you probably know, our memories are far from perfect. Just how imperfect? Here's an experiment for you. How many times have you seen a penny? Thousands. So tell me some things about pennies. Without looking, that would be cheating. Think of the side with Abe Lincoln in profile. Which way is he facing, right or left? You probably got that one. He's facing to the right. Now name 3 other things on that side of the penny. Take your time. Just dip into your memory banks. Give me 3 other features on that side of the penny. If you want to hit pause and think about it a minute, do so, but no cheating. Then come back. What are the other features on Abe's side of a penny? One of them's the date. Where is that? To the right of Lincoln or the left? It's to the right. You've got 2 features left. What are they? If you've got a really good memory, you'll remember that it says, "In God we trust," across the top. And the 4th feature? It's the one most people don't remember, even after handling pennies for their entire lives. The word liberty appears, just to the left of Lincoln's profile. Our memories are imperfect. They're also selective. Gamblers remember the times they won much more effectively than the times they lost. That's part of what keeps them gambling. There's another distressing aspect about memory. We think of our memories as photographs of real events filed away for future reference. But they are often less a function of the original photograph than of later representations. Our memories, however vivid, are often backward reconstructions from later reports. You may have a memory of some crazy thing you did when you were a kid. Remember that Thanksgiving that Pat snuck into the kitchen and ate the whole choke cherry pie by himself? Chances are, however vivid your memory, that what you remember is a reconstruction from the family stories of that event rather than the event itself. After I discussed this in one of my classes, one of my students went home for Thanksgiving and asked her family about a particularly vivid memory she had from her childhood. It turned out that the event she remembered so vividly as happening to her had in fact happened to her sister instead. The influence of verbal framing on memory has also been studied in the lab. Elizabeth Loftus is one of the world's foremost experts on eyewitness testimony. This is one of her classic studies. People were shown a film of a traffic accident and were then asked questions about it. Immediately after viewing the film, half the people were asked, about how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? The other half were asked, about how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? The only difference was how the question was phrased. About how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? About how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? 1 week later, the same people were asked a few more questions. Did you see any broken glass? There was, in fact, no broken glass in the accident. But if you had been asked about cars smashing into each other, rather than hitting each other, you were twice as likely to say that there had been. The difference in a single word created different memories. I performed eyewitness experiments several times in class. It's all staged, of course. Several graduate students come in the back of the class. One of them yells something, another throws a water balloon. A third grabs my briefcase and ducks out a side door. All three of the perpetrators are wearing colored baseball caps. The whole thing takes about 15 seconds. Immediately afterwards, students are given questionnaires to fill out. But in fact, the questionnaires are different. Half of the students are asked, what did the guy with the green baseball cap say? The other half are asked, what did the guy with the blue baseball cap say? There was, in fact, no blue baseball cap. But when asked about the incident a week later, lots of the kids with the second question report seeing a blue baseball cap. They all saw the same incident, but what they remember may be a factor not of what happened, but of what they were asked later and how. The fact that memories are so easily manipulated by later questioning has some very serious consequences. Child abuse is a real problem, but so is the prospect of false memories of child abuse. Eyewitness testimony can be all too easily slanted by certain forms of police questioning. So no wonder we make so many mistakes. Our perceptual system is hardwired for some contexts and not others. Our information processing comes with attention bias. We're change blind. Our memories are malleable in terms of later questions and reports. If that weren't bad enough, it's also the case that some of our patterns of reasoning come mistake prone. In the previous lecture, I talked about heuristics that make us smart, fast and frugal, intuitive rules of thumb that often seem to pay off. But there are also heuristics that make us dumb. Those are patterns that we use all the time and that don't pay off, habitual patterns of thought or perception that systematically mislead us. One's called an availability heuristic. So here's a simple test. Are there more English words that start with the letter K, or more English words that have the letter K in the third position? If you're like most people, you said there are more English words that start with the letter K. Why? It's easy to rattle off words that start with K. Kite, kangaroo, kindergarten, Kool-Aid. It's easy to think of words that start with a K. Those words are available, and we follow an availability heuristic. If it's easier to think of, we tend to think it's more common. But in fact, there are about three times as many English words that have a K in the third position. Bike, ask, acknowledge. It's a lot harder to think of words in terms of a third letter rather than a first letter. But that has nothing to do with how many there are. The availability heuristic misleads us. We take how easy it is to think of something to indicate how common or probable something is, and that's where we go wrong. In many cases, we tend to think in terms of simple and vivid images. That's fine if all we're interested in is a single case. The problem comes when we generalize from those single cases as if they were genuinely representative. Sometimes our vivid and available images come from media exposure. Images in the news are there because they're newsworthy. But when those become our vivid images, we tend to overestimate their probability. So which should you worry about more, airplane crashes or car crashes? Clearly, the latter. There are many more car crashes than plane crashes, and many more people are injured or killed in car accidents. But airplane crashes tend to be big news. Car crashes don't. Because of that, people overestimate the relative risks of air travel. What's the chance of being murdered? What's the chance of dying from stomach cancer? Murder makes the news, and it's overestimated. It's about 5 times as likely that you'll die of stomach cancer. Shark attacks and death by lightning are vivid images, but they're not vivid because they're common, quite the opposite. When we reason about frequency or risk of events in terms of images alone, it's the availability heuristic that's the source of our mistakes. Just as images can mislead us, our starting points can. Those starting points are called anchors. Here it's an anchoring and adjustment heuristic that can mislead. The starting point, the anchor, can come from lots of places. It can come from something as simple as how a question is phrased. In talking about mistakes of memory, we mentioned the fact that memory can be influenced by how a question is phrased. It turns out the same holds for rational calculation. What percentage of African nations do you think are members of the United Nations? Is it more than 10%? Give me a figure. What do you think the percentage really is? People who were asked the question that way tended to give answers averaging about 25%. Other people were asked the question this way. What percentage of African nations do you think are members of the United Nations? Is it more than 65%? Give me a figure. What do you think the percentage really is? In that case, the average answer was 45%. Why? The theory is that the figure given in the question is taken as an anchor. Is it more than 10%? Yeah, it must be more than that. So you adjust up from that anchor. You end up in the 25% range, perhaps. Is it more than 65%? No, that seems a lot. People use 65% as the anchor and they adjust down. They end up in the 45% range. But of course, the real probabilities have nothing to do with how the question is asked. Something like 93% of African states are members of the United Nations. The anchor and adjustment heuristic has led us astray. Then there's this rationality problem. We all think we're better than average. Garrison Keillor classically began his stories with, "Welcome to Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average." It's a joke, of course. It can't be true that all the children are above average. And yet, when people are asked about their driving skill, almost everyone rates themselves as above average. When asked about how attractive they are, almost everyone rates themselves above average. We also tend to be overconfident in our own abilities. We tend to be overconfident in our ability to stick to a diet, for example, or to keep with the gym plan. We tend to be overconfident in our ability to make money in the stock market or to win at the casino. Even there, we think we'll do better than average. It's become known as the Lake Wobegon effect. According to Stefano Della Vigna, an economist at UC Berkeley, overconfidence is a general feature of human psychology. Almost everyone is overconfident. The only exception, he says, are people who are depressed. They're the ones who tend to be realists. That makes me think twice about whether overconfidence should be considered an intellectual vice after all. If the alternative is depression, we may be better off thinking of ourselves as above average. With confidence, even overconfidence, comes a life of exploring new options, trying new things, dreaming big. That sounds better to me. Maybe realism is overrated. The take-home message? Some of the sources of mistakes we've said are built in. All we can do about those is know that they're there and compensate for them. Don't assume that the color things look is the way they really are. Some sources of mistakes are built into our information processing. Be aware that attention bias may blind you to other things going on. Don't bet on your ability to notice all changes around you. We all tend to be change blind. And don't treat your memory as photo perfect in all cases. What you remember is malleable to suggestion and later representation. Some of our mistakes stem from unreliable heuristics. Some of those we can deliberately avoid. We can see them coming and steer clear. In order to avoid the availability heuristic, think beyond a single image. Anchor an adjustment, be suspicious of that anchor wherever it comes from. Better than average, be aware that your estimates tend in that direction and compensate for them when necessary. In another lecture, an earlier lecture, we talked about simple heuristics that make us smart. So, are heuristics good or bad? Both. What we need to do is to use the good ones and avoid the bad ones. Even better, be aware of the heuristic you're using and pay attention to both how it might help and how it might lead you astray. Heuristics are rules of thumb for patterns of thought. I talked earlier about von Neumann's deliberate attempt to stock his mind with potentially useful technical formulae. But you don't have to be von Neumann, and the conceptual patterns don't have to be technical. Collecting patterns of thought across cultures can do the same thing, even if the patterns are as simple as fairy tales. Let me give you a puzzle. A treasure hunter is going to explore a cave on a hill near a beach. He suspected there might be many paths inside the cave and was afraid he might get lost. Obviously, he didn't have a map of the cave. All he had with him were some common items, such as a flashlight and a bag. What could he do to make sure he didn't get lost when trying to get back out of the cave? If you want to take a minute to think about it, press pause and come back. What could he do to make sure he didn't get lost in the cave? He could take a bag full of sand from the beach and sprinkle it along his path. When that puzzle was given to American college students, about 75% gave that solution. But when the puzzle was given to Chinese students, only 25% solved it. Why? The theory is that American students had a heuristic. They had a template of how to solve this kind of story. They had the story of Hansel and Gretel. Now let me give you another puzzle. Let's see if you get the answer to this one. In a village by a river, the chief of the region took care of its sacred stone statue. It was the chief's custom every year to go downriver to the next village to collect taxes. To assess the amount of taxes, the chief would ask for the statue's weight in gold coins. His method of measuring this amount was to put the statue in a large tub at one end of a hanging balance scale, hook the other end of the scale to another large tub. This second tub was filled with gold coins, until the scale balanced the weight of the statue. During one trip to collect taxes, the chief forgot to bring his balance scale. Now he had a problem. How could he figure out how much gold to take to match the statue's weight without the benefit of a balance scale, a pulley system, or a conventional scale? If you want, take a minute to think about that one too. That one's not so easy, right? Only 25% of American college students got a solution to that one. But 75% of Chinese college students did. That's because they had a different heuristic from a different folk tale. I'll finish with the folk tale of Chao Chang. Chinese students had grown up with this story, with this template, much as American students had grown up with Hansel and Gretel. Long ago in China, there lived a powerful emperor. Every year, the rulers of the surrounding countries had to give him jewelry, gold, cloth materials, and animals as presents. One day, a ruler of a southern country presented him with an elephant as a gift. The emperor was delighted to see the elephant and asked the ruler what the weight of the elephant was. The ruler was embarrassed because even the biggest scale he owned was too small to weigh the huge elephant. The emperor's youngest son, named Chao Chang, came up with an idea. You could find a boat, put the elephant in it, and mark the new water level on the boat. Then you could take the elephant out of the boat and put smaller stones into the boat until the water level reaches the same mark. Then you could weigh those stones separately with a small scale. When you add up all the weights, you'd know how heavy the elephant is. By crossing cultures, you now have two heuristics, two templates, Hansel and Gretel and the story of Chow Chang. In the next lecture, I want to talk about rationality in social interaction. In particular, how to be rational in a polarized context. We seem to find ourselves in the midst of increased polarization. Polarization of argument, polarization of opinion, polarization of value. What's the role of rationality in a polarized context? What should the role of rationality be? On a more individual level, is it possible to have a rational discussion with people who seem to disagree with you so radically on such fundamental issues? Is it possible to cut through? Is there a way for rationality to reduce polarization? That's what this lecture is about. I want to start with the facts about polarization in America, but first it's important to make a distinction. What I'll call partisan polarization is polarization between political organizations on the scale of either major political parties or smaller interest groups. What I'll call cultural polarization is polarization within the general public on attitudes that may or may not be expressed politically. First, the bad news. Partisan polarization is real. In 1980, only 43% of Americans polled said they thought there were important differences between the parties. The figure is now 74%. In 1976, almost a third thought it didn't even make a difference who was president. That figure is now cut in half. Internal uniformity within each party has grown, just as distance between them has. There was a time when members of Congress often crossed party lines. Between 1969 and 1976, the Nixon and the Ford years, the rate at which Republicans voted along party lines was about 65%. In both the House and the Senate. The same was true of Democrats. Between 2001 and 2004, under George W. Bush, Republicans voted with their party 90% of the time. Democrats voted with their party 85% of the time. Partisan polarization like that isn't new. George Washington's farewell address in 1796 emphasized the danger of factions. Quote, "One of the expedients of party to acquire influence is to misrepresent the opinions and aims of others," he said. "The spirit of party kindles animosity and agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms." A year later, Thomas Jefferson complained that because of partisan polarization, men who have been intimate all their lives cross the streets to avoid meeting. Sound familiar? Jefferson observed it, but he didn't reverse it. Until the very last part of their lives, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams treated each other in precisely that way. Partisan polarization has increased over the last few decades, but there's also some good news. Cultural polarization, polarization in general social attitudes among the general public, may not have. Morris Fiorina, an expert on the topic, says that increased polarization is primarily a political phenomenon. Partisan polarization between political activists or within the political elite. But of course, it's the political activists and the political elite who make the news. We've noted before that media sources may lead us to overestimate the frequency of the dangerous events that appear in the news. The impression that not just partisan politics, but cultural views in general are polarizing may be a media effect as well. Polarization in public attitudes is limited to a few hot-button issues. On most issues, public polarization hasn't increased between groups, regardless of what groups are being compared, the young and the old, men and women, the more and the less educated, different regions of the country, or different religious affiliations. On a number of fronts, polarization has in fact decreased. Views on women's role in public life are no longer the hot-button issue they once were. Racial integration was once fought vociferously by major portions of the population. Not now. Support for the death penalty has fallen, though opinions of crime have moved toward tougher enforcement. And those changes have operated in parallel across those different groups. It's polarization on a few hot-button issues that makes the news. Abortion and gay marriage are prime candidates. Views even on taxation, government, and the deficit are much less polarized than the politicians would have you think. Well over half of voters think that both spending cuts and higher taxes will be needed to reduce the deficit. So what explains the polarization we do see? Let me give the answer the political scientists tend to give, followed by some bits of data from the sociologists. Then I'll turn to the internal and logical dynamics of polarization, which is of particular interest to philosophers, the quasi-rational part of the picture. Political scientists concentrate on partisan polarization, of course. They note historical changes in the parties north and south. The Republican Party has drifted strongly to the right. Republican and conservative coincide much more closely now than in the past. In the Democratic Party, Northern Democrats have become somewhat more liberal than in the 1960s. More important is the change in the South. Southern Democrats were once an important voting bloc, different and in many respects less liberal than their Northern counterparts. That voting bloc now affiliates itself with the Republican Party. Sociologists add some observations regarding social and cultural polarization. Since the 1970s, we've sorted ourselves more residentially by income and social class. Our neighbors are increasingly like ourselves. Sociologists also note that America has a long history of fraternal and voluntary organizations. The Rotary Club, Lions, Kiwanis, Masons, Oddfellows, the Elks. Local chapters often drew members from various occupational and class levels across the community. They brought people together with people who might not be exactly like them. But membership in those long-term organizations has waned, replaced with self-selecting short-term membership in groups organized for some single political purpose. Let me shift from political and social observation, however, to a philosophical analysis of the dynamics within polarization. When you think about it, it seems that a polarization of attitudes or opinions is to be expected. It may even follow something like rational lines. I'll follow our earlier strategy of going to extremes, exaggerating in order to present the issue as simply as possible. Suppose that Mr. Magoo is very much convinced of a particular opinion. He's just sure that that position is right. Because he's convinced that the position is right, he's convinced that any evidence offered against the position must be flawed in some way. Bad research, perhaps, or an improper interpretation. Because Magoo is convinced his position is right, he's convinced that any argument offered on the other side must somehow be a bad argument. It must rely on some trick or some logical fallacy, or go wrong just because of that flawed data. In the philosophical literature, Mr. Magoo is what's called a Kripkean dogmatist. The term comes from a lecture by the contemporary philosopher Saul Kripke. Mr. Magoo thinks a particular position is right, and that alone seems to give him reason to be suspicious of any counter-evidence, any counter-arguments. The position's right, so there has to be something wrong with anything that seems to go against it, even if he can't put his finger on what. Mr. Magoo is an extreme case. He thinks his current position is right, and on that ground is prepared to reject any information to the contrary. Conspiracy theories seem to work very much that way. I'm sure you're too young to remember. The Beatles were at their height in the 1960s when the rumors started that Paul McCartney was dead, killed in a car crash in 1966. The evidence? Clues from the albums. In A Day in the Life, John Lennon sings, "He blew his mind out in a car. He hadn't noticed that the lights had changed." Aha! A reference to the accident. If you listen closely to John at the end of Strawberry Fields Forever, you can hear something that sounds like, "I buried Paul." And what about the visual evidence? On Magical Mystery Tour, Paul's the only one wearing a black carnation. Aha! The Fab Four crossing the street on the cover of Abbey Road, John's dressed in white as the religious figure. Ringo is in black as the Undertaker. George is in faded blue jeans. He's the gravedigger. Paul's the only one in bare feet. The corpse. It should be easy to refute a rumor like that. Just have Paul do an interview and show everyone he's alive. This is where the strategy of the Kripkean dogmatist comes in. Not so fast. If Paul's dead, that can't be real. Seems to me I remember a Paul McCartney look-alike contest run in one of the teen magazines, and the winner was never announced. Aha! There's still a Flat Earth Society, and there have been some serious flat earthers. In 1956, a spokesman for the society was asked about satellite images from space that showed the Earth as an oblate spheroid rather than a flat disk. His response? "It's easy to see how a photograph like that could fool the untrained eye." Here's how this offers an analysis of polarization dynamics. Imagine two people strongly convinced of two opposing positions, Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss, perhaps. Both are Kripkean dogmatists. Both selectively reject evidence and argument against their position. Both are selectively receptive to evidence and argument for their position. Now suppose they're given a mixed bag of new evidence and arguments, just like we get on just about every topic every day. The new information includes a handful of evidence and arguments that seem to point in one direction, but also a handful that seem to point in the other. One might think, one might hope, that new evidence and argument would bring the two views closer together. But if we're dealing with Kripkean dogmatists, that's not what's going to happen. Magoo will look at the totality of evidence, reject the pieces on the other side, and accept those that favor his current position, thereby strengthening it. Dr. Seuss will do the same, rejecting exactly the opposite handful of studies and arguments, strengthening his position as well. Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss will become even further and more firmly polarized. There's nothing inherently polarizing about the handful of evidence and arguments they see. It may equally represent both sides. But if attitudes start out already polarized, it can make them even more so. Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss are the extreme case. They are prepared to reject all contrary evidence on the basis of their current positions. But that same dynamics will operate even when the case isn't that extreme. There are a set of classic studies in social psychology that show precisely this effect. Individuals' attitudes toward the death penalty were measured. Subjects who favored the death penalty were put in one group. Those who opposed it were put in another. Both groups were then given the same two pieces of evidence. One piece of evidence supported a claim of deterrence. It was, in fact, a study that compared murder rates for the year before and after the adoption of capital punishment in 14 states. In 11 of those 14 states, murder rates were lower the year after adoption. The other piece of evidence went against deterrence. This one was a study that compared murder rates in 10 pairs of neighboring states, where one state had the death penalty and the bordering state didn't. In 8 of the 10 pairs, murder rates were higher in the state that had the death penalty. Each group was also given further information on the two studies, experimental details, critiques in the literature, and the researchers' response to those critiques. So both groups studied the totality of evidence and were again asked about their opinions regarding the death penalty. The result? Just as you'd expect from Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss. All participants found the evidence supporting their position better conducted and less subject to criticism than the counter evidence. Both groups ended up indicating stronger commitment to their position than when they began. There's another dynamics in polarization that hasn't yet been strongly studied. My prediction is that it will get increased attention. In fact, I'm working on it in some of my own research. The issue is selection of information sources. There was a time when America had one basic television news source, the NBC, CBS, and ABC nightly news. Because of the canons of journalism, they tried to avoid an overt political stance. Walter Cronkite was repeatedly cited as the most trusted man in America. That time is past. We have Fox News and MSNBC clearly polarized politically. Instant access to any slanted source is immediately available on the internet. Now, not only will Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss treat identical information differently, they'll seek out information differently. Mr. Magoo will trust information sources that reinforce his existing beliefs. Dr. Seuss will do the same on the other side. Because both will be able to find media reinforcing their existing beliefs, we can expect polarization to increase. That's what the internal dynamics of polarization might look like. And you have to admit that there seems to be something rational about that dynamics as well. Suppose you do have reason to believe a particular position. Isn't that also reason to believe that the counterposition is incorrect? Isn't that reason to believe that arguments for the counterposition have to be wrong? Not only do we often reason this way, it seems we have to. We can't constantly reconsider every position on every issue from the ground up, given every new piece of information that comes our way. We have to put new information through some initial plausibility filter, simply in order to know what's worth paying attention to and what's not. That seems to be an essential mechanism, not just in everyday life, but in normal science. Not every wacky claim from every corner is given equal consideration. There are studies that are poorly done, trumpeting results that we have full reason to believe aren't right. Working scientists need an initial plausibility filter, too. What can we base that plausibility filter on, except the theories we think we already have good evidence for, or the opinions we're already sure of? What differentiates our case from that of Dr. Seuss and Mr. Magoo? The consensus in the philosophical community is that there is indeed something rational about the dynamics we've been talking about, but not enough to justify Kripkean dogmatism, not enough to justify Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss. Remember that the Kripkean dogmatist rejects any new evidence and any new argument. He's sure his position is right. Nothing you can offer him to the contrary is worth looking at. What that really means, however, is that he takes whatever originally led him to his current position to trump any evidence since. That's the irrational part. Everyone agrees that the rationality of a position depends on the total available evidence. Now, if you knew there were 100 pieces of relevant evidence on a topic, would you make up your mind on the basis of just 3 that you happened to come across first? No, that would be irrational. But that's what the Kripkean dogmatist is doing. Of course, people decide on positions for all kinds of reasons, many of which have nothing to do with the evidence. But let's give Mr. Magoo the benefit of the doubt. Let's assume that he really did come to the position he now holds by looking at available evidence. Even so, the evidence he used to form his view originally was a long time ago. It didn't include all the relevant evidence because it didn't include the evidence that's coming in now. That means that he made up his mind on the basis of some small sample of evidence, the evidence that happened to come his way long ago. That's what's irrational. Here again, Magoo is an extreme case, but the lessons carry over to more realistic setups as well. Suppose it wasn't just 3% of the relevant evidence that someone used to form their opinion. Suppose it was 30%. Suppose the person isn't totally impervious to new evidence from the other side. They just think they have grounds to be skeptical. That gives us a sliding scale rather than an all-or-nothing measure. Full Magoo-like irrationality comes with total imperviousness to new evidence. on the basis of a position grounded in a very small or very ancient selection of the data. A position will be more rational the more data behind it, the greater proportion of the evidence that informs it. A position will be more rational the more it remains open to incoming information. If perfect rationality would demand being open to all evidence on all topics all the time, I suppose none of us can be perfectly rational. Our cognitive limitations are such that we have to do some filtering. That applies even to a social institution like normal science. We can still use the idea of an even-handed openness to new evidence as a rational ideal and a reminder to avoid becoming Kripkean dogmatists. There's a good warning indicator of when two people might be falling prey to the dynamics of polarization we've been talking about. Suppose you and a friend agree on lots of things. On all of those, she seems as perfectly rational as you do. She handles the evidence well. She's alive to subtleties of argument, a smart cookie. Not much gets past her, and I'll bet she thinks much the same of you. But her position on issue X just seems radically wrong. Stupid, even. How can she possibly think that? That's the warning indicator. It is hard to believe that someone so rational in other areas could be so irrational in area X. That's a sign that it's time to lay out evidence and argument on both sides, recalibrate, and reevaluate. There's no guarantee that like-mindedness will result, but strong disagreement in a small area with a person you think is generally rational is an indicator that you may be playing Mr. Magoo to their Dr. Seuss. How do we fix polarization? How do we try to have a rational discussion in a context that's already polarized? The literature on negotiation strategies seems to fit surprisingly well. William Ury and Robert Fisher are members of the Harvard Negotiation Project, authors of the influential Getting to Yes. Let me adapt some of their tips to the present case. A major theme in their work is removing an issue from its ties to emotion and ego. That applies here too. Rationality deals in cool-headed evidence and argument. To the extent that we have mere emotion on both sides, rationality doesn't have much of a chance. There's room for progress if both sides can say, "Wait a minute. I know we each feel strongly about this, but there is a real intellectual question at stake. Let's try to put the emotion aside and take a hard look at the issue itself." Ury speaks of this step back from emotional involvement as going to the balcony. The idea is for both sides to try to view the issue as if they were not embedded in it. Try to see it from a distance, as if the positions were being advanced by someone entirely different. That's an approach to polarized discussion that could be used unilaterally. But it's going to be more effective if both sides recognize that the issue is emotionally laden and both attempt to go to the balcony. A correlate theme is ego distancing. People identify with the views they hold. That's part of the problem. I'm arguing for my position. You're arguing for yours. But of course, neither truth nor rationality care whether a position happens to be mine or yours. Look, this isn't about us. If an issue can be cast as one for joint resolution through joint effort, that's a step away from individual ego, and it's clearly a step in the right direction. Public debate is not the best context in which to drop ego identification, even if it's around a table at Thanksgiving. That's a context in which people have too much to lose. So change the context. Let's agree on some quiet discussion together on a long walk. As long as a discussion is framed in terms of winning and losing, ego involvement is inevitable. That's why debates are probably not the best ways to arrive at a clear examination of an issue. Adversarial confrontation constitutes the public part of a criminal trial, but the real decision is made by someone else, in discussion, behind closed doors, by the jury. Professional philosophers have a major stake in logic and rationality, but I have to say that it's only been very rarely that I've heard a philosopher say in the midst of a public discussion, Oh, I see. Yes, I was wrong. You're right. Much more often, the change of mind is made offstage. Somehow that helps. You know, I've been thinking about your arguments yesterday. I've got a few questions, but I think you might be right. Uri and Fisher urge people to avoid positional negotiation. In positional negotiation, people identify themselves with specific positions from the start, positions to be won or lost. In positional negotiation, one seems forced into one of two roles. You end up either a soft negotiator or a hard negotiator, but neither of those really works. The soft negotiator wants to avoid conflict and so gives in. He often ends up feeling exploited, stepped upon, and bitter. The alternative is to be a hard negotiator, out to win and giving as little as possible every step of the way. In negotiation between hard negotiators, both start at absurd extremes, so that even if they do have to make a few concessions, they'll still be within their target area. One can expect that kind of negotiation to be a lengthy and drawn-out procedure. It might well break down. Positions don't get softer. Ego involved, emotionally driven, and with an emphasis on winning, hard positions just keep getting harder. What holds for negotiation holds for discussion in a polarized atmosphere as well. As long as the context is one of winning and losing, emotion and ego identification, one either gives in, feeling one has sacrificed truth, principle, or rationality to buy a little peace, or positions end up hardening to the point that they threaten the relationship itself. The alternative is to change the game. If the context can be changed from a contest of wills to a mutual exploration and investigation of an issue, then there's a chance. In leaving positional negotiation behind, Uri and Fisher urge people to look for a way to settle issues in terms of objective criteria. In the case of negotiation, that may mean an appeal to independent standards. Can't agree on the price for the house? What if we compare houses in the same area that have sold in the last 6 months? Can't agree on the depth of the foundation? Let's decide it on the basis of government specifications for these soil conditions. The idea is to ask in advance, what would settle the issue, agree on that, and then appeal to it. The same thing can work with rational discussion. Once we've removed emotion and ego as much as possible, once we've gone to the balcony and are trying to view it as an issue for joint investigation, rather than for ego-invested debate, let's try to agree on what might actually settle the issue. How would that work? The debate context is one in which opponents start with positions on, say, deterrence on the death penalty. If we can change the game, we have collaborators investigating deterrence in the death penalty. That allows us to look at the totality of evidence. But let's decide in advance, what kind of evidence should convince us that there is an effect? What kind of evidence should convince us that there isn't an effect? If we can do that, we can look with new eyes at what the evidence actually is. We can stop being Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss. We may actually reduce polarization. Sometimes the dispute isn't over data or evidence, but over background principles. There, discussion has to go deeper. One thing to ask is what principles are at play and what kind of principles those are. Proponents of gun control tend to emphasize statistics regarding harm. Opponents of gun control tend to emphasize constitutional rights. But if you take them out of the context of debate, people on both sides recognize that the Constitution says something important about rights. People on both sides recognize that we should avoid unnecessary harm. If we can get from polarized people to joint recognition that the issue is one of conflicting principles, we've made progress. There are several points I hope you'll take home from this lecture. First, some of the data on polarization. Partisan polarization is real, and the media emphasizes the hot-button controversies. When you look more generally at cultural attitudes and consider the population as a whole, it's not true that an enormous split is growing between us. I want you to take home the image of Mr. Magoo and Dr. Seuss. discounting evidence out of hand simply because it clashes with their existing positions. That dynamics is predictable. As a filtering device, it may even be rational.